This is Bob Schultz. This is the fourth session on the ministry based on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. Okay. Yesterday we were talking about the role that is played by ordained ministry and by lay ministry in the world. And what we basically said is that BEM sees ministry as being directed toward all people who are called to, that all people are called to be the people of God. And that baptism is designates us as people who have special functions in service to all the people, and brings with it the grace of the anointing of the Spirit. And in our sections on baptism, we had talked about the way in which in the early church, no one, baptism was immediately followed by anointing with the Spirit. Now, we talked also about the way in which ordination set some people aside for special functions in relationship to the baptized. So, all people in the world are called to be God's people. People who are baptized have special functions in relationship to those people, and the ordained ministry has special functions in relationship to the baptized. And we talked about those functions of ordained ministry as being typified by what takes place in the leadership of worship. And that's the point that our discussion was at. It's hard to pick up in the middle again, and we won't be able to do that exactly. But we can go back. I think we can begin to pick up the key questions which remained. One of the questions which we were discussing yesterday is the question as to how it is that the energy of faith becomes the energy of works, of the works which Christians do in the world. We also talked about the way in which one not only has a ministry to certain people, but the way in which those people must authorize you and empower you to carry out that ministry. So just as a pastor is ordained by the church and called by the congregation, but must be received as the pastor by each individual member, so it is important to remember that the individual Christian being sent by God, also as part of that ministry needs to work at creating the situation in which the people who are being served will give to the Christian their own authority to carry out that ministry among them. I have the feeling, as I look around the group, that it's considerably smaller than it was last time, and I would guess that only 3 or 4 of you were here, about half of you were here yesterday. Am I right on that, or were all of you here? Just trying to decide how to go. What questions would you want to raise out of yesterday's discussion? Yeah.
Well, I was intrigued as we got into what the process that's happening at worship and sort of the role of the ordained minister as that facilitator. And I could identify with that because I've thought of some of our lay Sundays and how there's not quite the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, some real important things come, and I'm sure we all coming from it. Well, I also went back to the idea where Christ says where 2 or 3 are gathered in my name, and he does consider us an ordained minister will be there.
That's right.
And I just, so on one hand I'm appreciating it, and I just wondered if you might elaborate on that a little bit more. Because I found that really intriguing.
Well, I think that that there are two kinds of things that are happening in every relationship. There are conscious, rational things that are happening. So, for example, reading, teaching, singing of hymns, picking of hymns, reading of the liturgy. And it's fairly easy for those to happen. And it is quite true that anyone can do those. But there is in life a good deal that goes on that's unconscious, and irrational. I have regularly in these weeks been drawing people's attention to Bruce Reed's book, The Task of the Church and the Role of Its Members. It's a little pamphlet. It's expensive. It's $4.25. It's over in the bookstore. It's worth it. Reed also has a book called The Dynamics of Religion, and I think that the line of investigation that he is following is just one of the most fruitful things that I have come across in many years. But he tells a story about the way in which this projection takes place. He tells the story of a service in which someone in the toward the front of the church passed out, was keeled over flat out in the aisle, and everybody in the congregation, as is usual, if you're a pastor, you know this, did nothing. They perhaps saw it, perhaps didn't, but kind of stood. And was an English priest who reported this. The priest became aware that people were waiting for him to do something. And it was only after he did and asked some people to intervene that they did. But it was only after the service that it struck him that this was a congregation made up of doctors and nurses. Now, that most of us don't have very often in a congregation, when someone falls over, the doctor in the congregation will be right on the spot. But if that doctor is involved, if that physician is involved in worship, then it just may be that there will be that same set of reactions waiting. Now, what I think happens is that the things which are conscious and rational are things which are fairly easy to learn and to manage. And that's usually what we do the best job of teaching in seminary. We teach people how to do it. We teach them how to know it. Teach them how to say it. But we don't do a very good job of teaching them how to manage this whole side of congregational life, which is there not only in worship, but which is there in every area of the pastor's contact with the people. In other words, the people give to the pastor a significance greater than the pastor has by reason of his or her own person. Okay? So there's another way to look at this is that there is function, what you do, and there is status. Now, when the church ordains a minister, it seems to me what the church does is to say, in our opinion, this is someone who has been trained to do this, but who also has that charism, that grace, which we don't quite know how to teach, but which means that this person is equipped to handle these kinds of unconscious and irrational feelings on the part of the congregation and on the part of himself or herself, which most often take the form of the kinds of projections that we talked about yesterday.
People don't think during an emergency. About 2 months ago, one of the men in our choir, we have men up in the front row, and all of a sudden we were standing up for some of the ritual after the sermon. And he stood right ahead of me, and all of a sudden I saw him coming back like stiff as a poker. So I put my hands up and stopped him from falling. Everyone in the choir looked at each other. I said, the doctor is sitting in the audience. Get him up here right now. And he's one that works in the hospital. And so he finally, one of them got his attention. And then these people, excuse me for saying dumb, here were the people that were sitting on this one side where they were supposed to carry him up, still standing there looking, and the doctor finally said, lay him down so one can take his head and the other one take his feet and take him up to this room where the choir room was right behind. And then by the time that they got him out, and then the pastors were wondering why all the commotion in the choir, so one of them turned around and looked, and they could see something was going on. Well, when they finally, they called the medics right away because the doctor could pay them right away, and they came over very quietly, and they were working out in the back room. Nobody knew what was going on. Well, then when they were going to take him out, it was about the time that the church service was over. So they come by carrying their equipment, and with him on it, one of them holding the bag up here, people in the audience got out in the aisle ahead of these ambulance men that were trying to get him out. You think, what's the matter with people? Don't they think?
Well,
and then from then on until 3 o'clock that afternoon, I was running back and forth to the hospital with his wife, and then bringing her home, and then going someplace else with her. But people are so dumb.
Well, I wouldn't say that they're so dumb. I think that what happens is that in that kind of a situation, in worship, for example, that people get caught up in a process of worship and are so powerfully involved in that that they really are not entirely, as you say, not entirely in touch with reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that same thing can happen in your workplace. You know, a person can fall over like that, and in most cases, not too many people will come. You kind of look. You won't act right away. You'll kind of,
right.
I don't know, you just don't do it.
There's the assumption that there is someone else who should take care of this. And that is the assumption in the community. There are four basic assumptions that run through every community. One is that there is someplace, someone who is all-powerful and knows everything and will do it. And we can depend on that person in a very irrational way. Second one is that there is an enemy whom we either have to fight or run away from. And the third is that there are a couple of people in the community who have the capacity of really creating something totally new and quite different than anything we've experienced before. And the fourth is, very often, that things ought to stay the same. Now, what happens in church is that the whole worship service is designed to create, to focus on that feeling. That there is someone who knows everything and has all power and will take care of everything. That's God. Right? God is in his temple, let us all adore him. You know, all the earth keeps silence before him. I may not understand the meaning of the hymn that I'm singing, but God understands. I may sing bad notes, but God hears me singing on key. I don't know what I ought to pray for, but God knows what I need, and God will give it. The sermon certainly has relevance to what is happening in my life, and we will all sit and listen to it. At least for 20 minutes. We'll assume that. And the whole worship service is designed to create, to deal with that, create that feeling, basic feeling, so that we can deal with it. And get into it deeply enough to work with it and then to come out of it as people who go out into the community as being able to do things. Now, as part of that process of working through it, the pastor is the leader of worship. Plays certain functions, and perhaps you have experienced that if you've read the lessons. You probably are a fairly good reader, but you get up to read the lessons, and under that pressure of expectation, everybody out there looking at you, waiting for you to read, you make some simple, make a simple mistake. That's normal. Now, what has happened, you see, is that we have said to the lay reader, look, you can read. Here's the lessons. What we have not prepared the lay reader for is this, is that tremendous impact of being in front of a congregation, which is in some ways more intense than just being in front of an audience. Although being in front of an audience is puts enough pressure on us, somehow there is the feeling that in church it ought to, everything ought to be perfect, right? This is God's house, right? There shouldn't be any mistakes. Or if you're a pastor, you know the panic that comes from if you, at some point in the service, if your attention falters and you say, now, where are we? Then at that point, you can no longer remember where you are. Right? That's, you're fortunate if that happens in the middle of something because you can stop and listen to the congregation and find out and then get back. But when the pastor gets lost, right, can't find the page, or someone's moved the marker. Now you'd think that after all those years you'd know where it is in the book. But you really, really can't. Those pressures occur not only in church, all right? But church is the place that is designed to deal with that irrational side of life, which says there is someone who knows everything and who has all power. And who will take care of it? So we'll just sit back. Yeah.
Yesterday you were remarking about the projection that emerges in worship, the projection that they give the goodness to the pastor, as you said, and the pastor returns it, by the end of the service. And that seemed to be kind of a positive way of looking at it. Are there unhealthy projections, though, to the pastor that are not good projections?
The interesting thing about projection is that it is a two-way street. And it is important to realize that when you are in a situation in which projections are being made onto you, and I don't know what kind of work you do.
I'm a new pastor.
You're a new pastor, all right.
So I'm kind of struggling with this whole business. Yeah.
Well, then you've been in another career. You're probably a second career pastor.
I was a school teacher up until 6 months ago.
Okay. Well, as a school teacher, you had some experience with this. The children. I don't know what grade you taught, but if they were young enough, they assumed that you knew everything. I had a teacher who believed that. He did know everything. And so raising a question was seen as a challenge to his authority. Yeah. Because, of course, he didn't know everything. And if you started asking questions, it was entirely possible that you would ask a question that would reveal that he didn't know everything. And so you started asking questions, he got nervous. Because he was defensive against questions which might reveal that he didn't know everything. That would particularly come out when he made a mistake. One of my sons had a teacher who once said in class, who kept a dictionary in the classroom, and who made a statement, and my son asked if they could check it in the dictionary, and the teacher said, in this classroom, whatever I say is right, it's right. Okay. But that's really, in order to teach, your students have to assume that you know more than, have to be willing to operate under the assumption that you know more than they do. Although that may not be true at all. You know, we all learn from people who know a great deal less than we do. Okay. But we have to be willing to work with that assumption. Now, the projection goes wrong, right? In the way in which the person onto whom it is made uses it or manages it. The teacher can, you can come in and say, you know, I could come in and say, well, we're supposed to talk about this document. I don't know. I just picked it up in the bookstore. I don't really understand very much about it at all. I wonder, anybody here read it? Anybody got anything they want to say? We would very, very quickly destroy the atmosphere in which we could work effectively. Now, objectively, it certainly is true. There's a great deal that I don't understand about this document. A lot of questions I would like to raise to someone else. A lot of questions I'm raising with you that I would like to discuss with you. But I need to keep my, not refuse to reveal my ignorance, but I need to be careful in the way in which I say, well, you know, I have trouble understanding that too. Or I'm not sure what they meant by that. All right? I have, but in order to work together, there has to be a certain kind of assumption that there are some things which I am aware of which you may not be aware of, and therefore there can be a productive working relationship. And yet this is a discussion. We're sitting around the circle, right? We don't have the chairs auditorium style in front of the in front of the blackboard so that I can give you the material, and the way in which we arrange ourselves for seating already says something about the style in which we work together. Yeah? Now, in church, we all sit looking at the backs of each other's heads. All focused, the only face we see is the pastor's face. Hopefully the choir isn't too noticeable. We see the pastor's face, and because that's a situation of being very, very dependent upon the pastor. Now, if you can think about that dimension of teaching and the way in which you manage that, and yet how when you went out of the classroom, you had to be willing to say, well, there's a great deal that I don't know and a great deal I still have to learn. I'm going to go back to school this summer and take some more courses, work on another degree. Go home tonight and read the journal. So a pastor has that not with knowledge, and that's the issue, not with knowledge, but with holiness. When the pastor steps into the chancel, and that's why we use the robes and all, There are many things that say we are here not dealing with the reality of who that pastor is as an individual, but we are dealing with this pastor as a symbol, as an ordained pastor, someone set aside by the church in order to carry out a role for the community which is different from the reality of that person. Yeah.
I think, you know, that's, you just brought up, I think, some really interesting points and some things that we've been sort of talking about outside this class. And one is that we seem to respect the pastor. I mean, we've all loved these morning Bible studies because he's saying to us, sharing all the stuff, but he also is real upfront about, I don't know all that. But now when it came to Sunday worship, I don't know that I'd want to see him doing that.
That's right.
Because I, just as you said, at that time, I see him more as the vehicle related to God, with God serving me. But sometimes as members, going back to how the ordained minister takes on those projections and uses it, there are some members who see this pastor in the light that they don't let down. And they don't say, make those comments, or they don't, just in their actions, maybe it comes across. And because of that, going back to what you talked about 2 days ago, that credibility isn't there. And on Sunday morning, it's just been occurring to me that some people then don't change his role. And then they still see him as what they may want to call a hair pastor or whatever. And I don't think that if you go into that frame of mind of reference, I mean into worship, that whole process of energy changing may not occur. Is that possible?
That's quite true, right.
Because you, that person there, you all of a sudden don't have faith in their role up there or something. I don't know. I'm just
well, two kinds of things, it seems to me, two kinds of things can happen when the pastor tries to say, the projection is really true about me. And I am really, I am 168 hours a week. I am what I am for that hour of worship on Sunday morning. Is that some people will say, our experience of the reality is that that isn't true. You really do not speak with the voice of God. Now, when we were, we had to, when the roof was leaking, it was really a foolish suggestion that you made. God knows you don't fix a roof that way. Okay. And then, so when the pastor pontificates, plays the role of the priest all during the week, it is impossible to keep that credible. Right. Or that will be for some people. There will be other people, however, who will have so given him all of their knowledge and all of their competence that they will feel that if the pastor doesn't have it, then it's lost. So you will then find the other people who, when you say the pastor really doesn't know how to fix the roof, will feel that that's blasphemy, that that is somehow an attack on the church. And then you get these highly emotional conflicts in churches.
There's a parallel here between children and parents, that as children begin to reach, you know, 10 or in the adolescence, if they discover something about that their parents don't know everything. And then there can often be a kind of resentment and a disillusionment about the world for a while till they establish their own, become aware of their own perceptions and stuff.
It's an exact parallel, what children do, and what I would assume most of us did when we were children, is to identify our parents or some other adults as being all-knowing, all-caring, all powerful. You need to have that
in order to have the safety and the security in which to say, I'm not. And then part of growing up is saying, well, I know more, I am able to do more, and I am now free to recognize that you know less and are able to do less than I once thought. It's more tolerable. And one of the difficult tasks of being a parent then is to give back, give to your children those projections and to say, there are things you are able to do for yourself. More and more things you are able to do for yourself. You know, and you, someday you say, you're able to drive the car for yourself. Or, you know, that's a really powerful position for a parent over against a child, to be able to drive the car, right? That's a real power. And the child ascribes to the parent a great deal more skill in driving and a great deal more control over that car than the parent probably really has. Right. But the parent then has to give that back to the child. And the difficulty in being a parent is wanting to hold on to more of it. To say, well, you can drive, but I'm really not sure about how well you can drive. When that's not necessarily realistic. No, I may say you may make some rash decisions when you drive. And we need to talk about it.
You still have to have the responsibility to check the oil, check the air in the tires, and make sure the car continues to run, that you feel that the child just can't do it because, you know, it's not determined.
Right. You've had that problem, right? Sure. I find myself, now that I'm older, continually looking at people in their 20s and saying, how can they trust such young people with such responsibilities? Are you really sure you know that you've been through medical school? Right. Yes.
How about that other side of it then, the giving back part? You know,
how do you give that back?
Yeah, you know, in the worship or in parent or the parent-child relationship, but let's say in the worship, what happens in giving that back?
Well, what happens is that even though, as a parent, for example, even though you know that you don't know everything and are not all powerful, you really do everything you can to take care of the child. And that means that the child can depend upon your knowledge and your strength rather than upon its own. And paradoxically, in that freedom can begin to develop its own knowledge and its own strength. Now that's what happens in worship when we start out with the confession of sins, we start out with prayer, we start out thinking about our absolute dependence upon God and all that we need from God. And it is, I believe, possible to distinguish various denominational liturgies in terms of how deeply they will let you go into that awareness. The Lutheran liturgy, for example, verbally lets you go into it very, very deeply. and says, this is a safe situation, this is a situation in which you don't have to worry about your strength or about how much good you've done during the past week. It's a situation in which it is safe for you to really ask yourself what things went wrong. Did they go wrong? Maybe they were worse than I thought they were. But you can really allow yourself to get in touch with that. And then, right, when you're in touch with it, then you can work with it. Now, what the Lutheran liturgy says is that whatever level you are in touch with that weakness and failure and even sin with in your own life, there is something you can do with that. You can give it to God.
Isn't part of that being aware that in the process of learning how to give God your weaknesses and maybe knowing how to live in a state where we're always dealing with our weaknesses, it seems like through that you gain a confidence in how to make the best use of your goodness.
But
because in fact last night I was talking, I think it was with Karen, about something I've noticed. That the more I've been able to work at my relationship with God, this is sort of outside worship, of course, but that more dependent on Him, more aware of it, I seem to have gained strength to do more with the gifts God's given me. I mean, I'm amazed at things I've been able to do the last few years ago, that a few years back, when my faith was much more mature, I don't think I would have done because I didn't have the confidence to do it. I mean, I'm sure God had those gifts in me, but I didn't have the goodness, and I kind of see that whole process is sort of happening through worship. I'm again reminded of my weakness, but it's sort of like this enabling force that you can go away with, and I'm wondering if that's part of the process of goodness, not just being aware of the goodness, but that confidence because of knowing Christ, that it's not only the goodness in itself, but the confidence to be able to use my goodness. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. I think that one of the things we're always struggling with in the church is that we recognize that happens, but to identify the process by which that happens. I think that what the service then permits us to do is to, for example, if I become, I think the first level is, though, is that whatever my experience of my own weakness is, the service needs to give me as much freedom as possible to be honest about that. There are ways in the service of making it difficult for me to be honest about that and saying, well, if you're past a certain point, then we really can't help you. And, for example, if you hate God, then we can't help you. So Christians don't say that. Whenever you come to something that if you were to say it to the pastor and the pastor would say, get out of the office, we just don't allow anyone to say that kind of thing here, then you've set a false floor, and you've said to that person, well, you've got to take that away and work with that for yourself. Now, the energy, when you get down there, the energy, for example, of your weakness, one of the things that you become aware of is your own shame, your own non-acceptance of yourself. You become aware of your own condemnation of yourself. And that's energy. Now, it's only by getting down to the bottom of where you are that you can get in touch with that, really get in touch with that energy. And when you're in touch with that energy, then the service leads you up. It says, well, you have examples in the Bible of the psalmists. You read the psalm and you hear something about the weakness of the psalmist. Okay? You read the Old Testament lesson, you hear something about this, not only about the strength, but also about the weakness of that person. Jeremiah, lesson on for Sunday, last Sunday. Jeremiah is feeling that God had deceived him. So here he is saying to the people, this is the word of God, and he's saying to God, God, you're playing games with me. And I can't trust you. Saying to the people, trust God, and he's saying to God, I can't trust you. Golly. or Jesus. The real weakness of Jesus, the cross, the suffering, the death, the rejection, the shame, that none of those were realities that prevented him from being the Son of God, or that prevented God from using him. So, as I get down to this level, I can then bring it up into the level of the conscious and the rational. And when it becomes conscious, then I can work with it. And when it is conscious, then I can leave it behind. It can be forgiven. Right? So now I have, now I, and this still seems to be a rather inadequate explanation of the rather complex dynamics of the service. But when I have worked with that and can then take the strength with me, then what the pastor does is to give me back the projection of the strength, and does that symbolically, not as though I really haven't had it for the last hour, but affirming its reality in the benediction, in the communion. Right? That is the process in which Christ takes what is mine, takes this, and gives to me what is his. And so then I can leave the church saying, well, yes, I can depend upon God, but this is what God has done for me. This is what God has equipped me to do. But it is that energy that I brought in this sense, that I can't really do anything, that God has to do it all, and that I brought in my own feeling of shame and guilt about my sin. And it is that process of transformation, and a ritual process of transformation, which takes place both on the conscious and on the unconscious level.
So the pastor's really, once you go through the process of confession and awareness, he's really making us aware then that once God takes away our sins, we're left with the goodness. I mean, it's sort of a reminder, what you're left with is the goodness, and go forth and serve, sort of.
Yes, but it's more than a, it's a kind of a conversion, a transformation of the energy, of the dynamic that is really there. So, yeah.
I wonder if it spoils it for the rest of the folk to say the pastor rejoins in this. At least this pastor does.
Mm-hmm.
I don't serve a congregation, have it for years and years and years. In fact, I have only served a congregation for 2 years out of the 100 that I spent in ministry. But I go through that same kind of thing. And whether I can, maybe I have an Alvinist stole on this, says all these things about positional holiness. I mean, there's the chancel, and there's this yoke of Christ, and all of these kind of things that say, I don't possess this holiness, but this is to remind you of the position somehow, of all this arrangement up here, and the Holy Bible and all that. But I go through that same kind of thing, and I'm never at ease until we're at the end, you know. But I try to prepare very carefully what it is that it seems to me most needs to be said in this situation. Every sermon has its own best way to be preached, and I do that. But I don't draw an easy breath until all that energy that I come with, you know, the inadequacy of speaking for God, all that stuff is done and finished with the benediction, then I'm on a high. And I can feel, you know, there was really something good. But the business of energy here, it seems to me to be very, very important in all that worship. And I just want to say that at least one pastor goes through the same kind of thing that everybody else is doing. At least I hope they're going through it, because that's what I'm trying to do. So I'm trying to lead.
Well, you're very much you're doing it representatively for the congregation. And if you lose your energy, it doesn't matter if I'm out in the congregation and I go to sleep during the sermon. Right? But it's when I go to sleep during the service myself that the service kind of falls flat. Or when I get so involved in the process that I can't remember where I am, it breaks the process for the people. Yeah. Yes.
Sometimes I think the most rewarding times for me preaching have been when I remember one Sunday when I was really sick and walked into the pulpit wondering if anybody had ever shown up during the sermon before. And another time was when I had a real troublesome personal problem on my mind. It was really hard to think of where I was. And yet it seems like it's during times like that when it's hardest that God comes through the most. And I have almost a stronger sense at the end of something like that of how very real God is and how amazing it is that God can use us. Even when, I mean, it's so obvious at that time, I guess, but it really isn't. It never is us alone, but how really strong God's presence and how He can use even the weakest, most distracted vessels sometimes to do good things.
That's
a real relief. I think it's a very I think I felt better at the end of the series school like that than I have some other trip to 100% Greek. Because it was...
Because you weren't involved, you were not involved in the process. When you go in feeling 100% great, and you don't have any anxiety, any tension, you're not involved in the process. You can put on a performance. You can go through the motions. But the people will not, the dynamics won't be there. And that is very easy to do in ministry, is to just go through. I remember the pastor who came to a funeral was no Lutheran, but he comforted the family by saying, "You don't have to worry. This is not going to be difficult at all. It hardly ever takes me more than 11 minutes to read the service." And it hardly ever did.
The pastor was obligated to preach in German. He resisted the idea, but at least he found one way. He found a book of German sermons, and he just grabbed it and put the bookmark in the next Sunday to read the next one. Until he discovered halfway through a sermon, he was reading one to an American audience, and it was a happy birthday to the Kaiser. Talking about not being involved with the process, he didn't even look ahead to see what the title was going to be.
I can't imagine that not being involved in the process.
Oh, can't you? Oh, sure.
No, maybe it's because I'm here, but I feel such a sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, you never know, and that goes for just being in the congregation too, as far as, you know, you never know when there might be a few people out there who maybe have not been a part of the church for years or have been self-alienated, and that may be their one time or just they decide to give it a chance. And if the word doesn't come alive to them, and if the people around them aren't actual living reminders of a loving and caring community, and if the word doesn't speak to them of a God who makes sense today,
well, there is the matter of leadership, and that is that that if you are leading a group, then you have to be in touch with the deepest level of experience in that group. If you are just a participant, you only have to be in touch with your own level. Because the leader does things in a representative way for all of the people in the group.
That's why it's easier to preach to the same group of people time after time and to preach occasionally to a new group. You can't get in touch in any depth with supply for you. I'm much more superficial than when I'm supplying the congregation that I have worship in, I don't know. But if I'm talking to the same group of people week after week, or even on some occasion familiar, I've been better.
It's time for first setting, so those of you, we'll pick this up again tomorrow. But I have, Don, worked with, have asked a whole series of interns. What has been the most unexpected thing that has happened to you at internship? And they have given me a whole variety of responses, but all of them centered around the theme. I realized that people were expecting something of me that I didn't have. First time I came into one of them said the first time I came into a room where someone was dying. Everybody looked at me as though I knew what to do.
And waited for
me to do it.
Right.